waiting for one speaker, but good afternoon and welcome. My name is Marlene Chimizu Sessions. This session is the Bonds of Community Hapa Identity in a Changing U.S. We're in Capitol Rooms 5 and 6, so if you're you should be in a different session. Now's your time to escape. In consideration for the panelists and the other audience members, please turn off or silence your cell phones. We request that you do that. No video or audio taping is allowed. The panel is being professionally audio recorded, and the audio files will be available on the janm.org website following the conference. Because of this, all our speakers will be using specially provided microphones. Your session moderator today is Gil Asakawa, and Gil will introduce today's panel. Gil?
Thank you, Marlene. I want to welcome everybody here. Thank you for taking the time. I know there are a lot of competing panels. If I weren't moderating this one, I'd be in two or three other ones right now. So I appreciate you coming by. Here's Dennis. Good. I won't have to stretch out my bio too much. I live here in Denver, and I am primarily kind of a writer, a media person. I've worked on the internet side of the newspaper business for a long time, and I've written a book called Being Japanese American, in which I said pretty plainly that Hapa are the future of the Japanese American community. So although I am not Hapa, believe that Hapa are more than a curiosity. Hapa are the future. And mostly that's because since the 1970s, the Japanese American population has had the highest outmarriage rate of any Asian immigrant community in the United States. Having been twice divorced to Caucasian women, I can attest to that, how that could happen. Although I never had any kids. I don't know if cats count. That's something we'll talk about. That we'll talk about how relationships happen and why exactly it is that Japanese Americans, more than other Asian populations, has a propensity to seek out non-Japanese. Maybe we're all rebelling against our parents and grandparents. First of all, before I get going with these two and have them introduce themselves, I want to ask how many Hapa are in the room? Raise your hand if you're a Hapa.
I'm half Japanese.
Okay. Explain that. Half Japanese but not Hapa. Okay, so Hapa is a slur, and that's something we wanted to talk about. The word, I'll just kind of say this now, because it's become pretty commonplace. It definitely started as a slur. It's a Hawaiian word. And in Japanese, the slur was hafu. And it was, to say hafu was always said, it was spoken with derision. And and in the last, I'd say, 10, 15 years, since I first really noticed the Hapa Project out of, I think it's UC Berkeley, there's an organization there, and I've kind of been aware of the term being more commonplace and not spoken with derision, kind of the way I guess in the gay community they embrace the word queer. I don't know if that's a good metaphor or not. It's for African Americans using. I don't know if it's used the same way. I don't know if Asians use the word hapa the same way African Americans use the N-word with each other.
Labeled. it's a way to group us, to sort of categorize us.
Interesting.
Yeah, it makes it easier to deal with.
Sure. Okay. No, I get that. I have heard Caucasians use the word hapa. So, I mean, I guess so. I see it being pretty mainstream now, is, I guess, my point. To where I hear, we were talking about this earlier, I've heard African Americans who are not part Asian call them, but that they are mixed race, call themselves hapa. And I've heard the same of Hispanics or Latinos who are, you know, like part Caucasian or part African American call themselves hapa. And there's a pretty popular sushi restaurant in the area that's called Hapa, and you know there's a Hawaiian pop band called Hapa. Maybe that's allowed because they're Hawaiian. It's a Hawaiian word.
I think there's a question.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's an interesting kind of a semantic puzzle. The point is, it's a good point, and it's a point worth making right away that hapa is a slur. Sure. Well, I would argue that we're already in a Sanse-based identity period, unless you're in the JACL, and that's very Nisei-based still. You know what? That's a really good point. I don't want to dismiss it, and I don't want to ignore it, and I think we should all think about it. But I do want to move on, and I want to let these guys talk, too. I did see another hand up back there. Sure. That's Kip Fulbeck. He's a performance artist, spoken word writer, professor, stand-up comic. He has a book, Part Asian, 100% Hapa. It's a book of portraits of mixed race Asians. Sure. Sure. That really gives me a lot of food for thought.
So, hey, Gil?
Yes, sir.
I'm a little concerned that the people in the back may be missing out because they can't hear what's the question.
Should we make them force them to move up, and we'll repeat the questions when questions are asked? So, a lot of the conversation here has been about a Janam exhibition about Hapa, and then Kip Fulbeck, who is the author of the book about Hapas, and all relating to kind of the currency of the term becoming more mainstream. But maybe it shouldn't be. Quite a few hapa or mixed race people in here. So now you got me really. mixed race people in the audience. And how many of you are Japanese American or Japanese ethnicity and something else versus non-Japanese? Okay. And how many of you have more than two races? Great. I think that's increasingly, again, the future. Multiple ethnicities. And then, as I talk to these two, I want you all to kind of think about it as well. If you're mixed race, you know, think about the questions I'm asking these two, because I want people to speak up and to be involved in the conversation, because really, I mean, you all could be up here talking about your experiences. And in fact, you all have more to say about it than I do, because I'm not mixed race. So to my right is Michelle Tamotsu-Tervino. And Michelle, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. My name is Michelle Tamotsu-Tervino, and I'm really thrilled to be here today. It's always wonderful for me to be able to talk about my experience and about these issues of being mixed race. I really thank you, but I also want to echo what Gil said, that we hope that this will be kind of a two-way conversation. And in particular, we were lamenting a little bit earlier that we didn't have somebody also who sort of represents the younger generation. So for those of you in the audience, we would really, really love to hear from you. If something moves you, or you have a different idea, or maybe you have a common experience. I'm Japanese on my mother's side. She was a war bride. And on my father's side, I'm Irish-American. My father actually worked for the U.S. government and went to work in Japan pretty much after the occupation of Japan after World War II. And my mother worked in the PX, which was the post exchange at that time. And, before they had, I guess, adding machines and things like that, and just did everything, in her head. Met my dad, and they dated for a few years. I mean, it was pretty controversial back then, in the 50s. Her family was not happy about her dating an American. And his family, I think, really didn't get that either, and his family was in Boston, and so they didn't really have a lot of support. So in a lot of ways, I look at them as being, pioneers in terms of being in an interracial relationship. But I also feel like I benefited, because I got to grow up overseas, and for a lot of people, maybe that they wouldn't think that that was, necessarily a positive thing. For me, it was, because I was exposed to my mom's family and to her culture. And, I really feel like I was able to have a very positive experience in that way. I'm not sure what would have happened if I would have grown up in some different regions in the United States. I grew up in Okinawa, in Japan, till I was 14, and then we moved to South Korea, and I finished up high school there, and then came out here for college, and I've been here ever since. So I've really had sort of a binational kind of experience. I think my experience growing up is probably very different from, some of my peers whose mothers were Nisei and who grew up here in this country. But I can, share some more about that later. Currently, I'm assistant director of the Center for Multicultural Affairs at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And there I coordinate both the Asian Pacific American Student Services and the Multiracial Student Services.
Dennis?
Well, I'm glad to see you all out here. I'll try and make it interesting. If you want to leave now, leave. But you'll be sorry. I'm Hapa. My mother was Japanese. My father was Caucasian. Their relationship, she tells me, before she passed, was a one-night stand. Immediately after I was born, I was placed in a orphanage, children's orphanage in Los Angeles, where I remained until such time as the government moved all the orphans from Washington to southern Arizona to Manzanar. So I'm from Manzanar. I was able to leave camp early, because the Bambauer family wanted to have an interracial family They were trying to have 12 children. My mother said when I arrived as the fourth and the oldest, she couldn't take any more. So that ended the project of brothers and sisters. In 1997, I hope some of you watched the 60-minute film on the children of the orphans in Manzanar. If you saw that, you got to see some of the history of my background in that particular program. That particular program was a coming out thing for me. I was asked by CBS to come to Manzanar to be interviewed, and I didn't know what they were interviewing or why. So I went, but that was my first return to Manzanar in some 40 years. And quite frankly, it was an emotional problem for me. As you see, I overcame it, but I've had a simple time being a Hapa, because when the Bambars took me out of camp, they took me to a community where there were no Japanese, and so it was very easy for me to pass. And so it wasn't until the CBS program that I began to identify myself to my friends and new acquaintances as being a Hapa. Now that also works another benefit, because when you say you're a Hapa to somebody who doesn't know a Hapa, you get to explain. And in explaining to them, you get to tell them some things that you want them to hear to change their attitude if they have an attitude about the subject. So I hope that you'll have questions. If you do, I want you to ask Gil.
And I'll make up an answer. Believe you me. Dennis, I have a question actually for you.
I don't want to hear it.
From what you just said, I take it that when you were a child, you looked more Caucasian than Asian.
Well, one of the things, yes. And one of the things that I found out in my research for this presentation and visiting with you folks was that there was very little written about Hapas. But I found that the markers accepted by the general population are all physical. You know, if you stop to think about it, I take off my glasses and I do not appear to have Japanese eyes. I'm too tall. If you want me to stand up beside you, I will.
No.
And all of those markers are what the non-Hapas identify with. And so I had to, or I was, and as you were, often asked, well, what race are you or who are you? Because I exhibit different markers. And so, you know, that's a question which is very personal. Uh-huh. And it indicates to you as an individual that you are different Or why would they be asking you that question?
Sure. And that's something that full-blooded Asians get all the time also. You know, the what are you? Or then the follow-up is, where are you from? You know, California. No, really, where are you from? California. Where's your family from? California. That kind of thing. Michelle, growing up, you grew up amongst my experience of the military, because I was also a military brat in Japan as a kid. My experience is that the military is more mixed than the general American population, and in some ways more accepting. How was your identity? And when you first came stateside, you know, to the mainland, how did you identify yourself? Did you feel like you looked Asian or Caucasian or?
Boy, that what are you question, I get that all the time, but not only does it stop there, but I often get, are you sure? Are you sure you're part Japanese? I can see the Irish side, but I don't really see the other side. So I guess I would just, you know, as you're talking to other Hapas or mixed race people, is probably not the way you want to go. You know, just kind of believe their experience and what they tell you. You know, I married a Trevino, so I married somebody who's Mexican American, and so that complicates it even more. Because, yeah. You know, regionally here, I get mistaken for being Latina.
You must be
Latina.
Hispanic.
Right. and then it just really, really aggravates me because, well, you know, my family will go to Hawaii for vacation, and my husband is always the one who's looked at as, oh, you must be the local who's returning. You must be Filipino. And he just loves it because he feels like he has an experience there where he phenotypically fits in and is accepted right away. And that, of course, is very, very different from Mexican-American experience here in Colorado, right? But you know, I grew up on military bases, but actually my father worked for the government. And so we didn't do the moving around every 2 or 3 years and coming back to the States. And so there was a sense of continuity. And we also had a lot of friends in our circle who were also, you know, Japanese wife and an American or Nisei husband. And so I think probably my experiences growing up in some ways closely match Hapa who grew up in Hawaii or Japanese American biracial people who grew up in Hawaii. But, you know, when I came here to the United States, I found I had to do a lot more explaining, you know, not only around being Japanese American, but around the mixed race piece. So it's a constant, you know, it's just a constant sort of having to explain who you are, what your background is, and just, you know, sort of taking it from there. The other thing I think that made it a little more difficult for me in terms of the Japanese American community here in Colorado was, you know, because my mother was a war bride, and she actually ended up passing away before she ever moved to the United States. You know, there's sort of that, it's a tight-knit community. It's sort of hard to, you know, to really access it in a lot of ways. And so for me, I think that was kind of a particular stigma, was that my mother wasn't JA, but she was a naturalized citizen through marriage. And then also just, you know, never did actually end up living here in her lifetime. So those are just some of my personal experiences.
Hey, Gil?
Yeah.
I'd like to throw out kind of a concept to the audience and see how it goes. But when I was in an orphanage, because I was a Hapa, was picked on by my fellow orphans. And I'm just wondering if some of our Hapas today are experiencing those same kinds of things, where you're singled out because you're a little different, having to explain the difference and so forth. Or have we as a culture and a nation moved past that to where we are less interested in who you are and more interested in what you are.
I think given our current presidential campaign, we have not moved beyond the who you are phase of race relations, and which is why I think it's doubly interesting and important to have these kinds of discussions. One question that I also had for you all in the audience, and feel free at any time to raise your hand, comment, talk back, are people of mixed race subjected to a different kind of prejudice or racism than just one race? You know, I mean, I grew up with, Ching Chong, go back to China, all of those things, you know, you dirty, sneaky Jap. Every one of those things I've grown up hearing. And I've, my assumption is that if you're a mixed race, it complicates it and you get a different layer of hate speech, as you will, on top of that. Is that true? Yes. Comes from both sides. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're not real.
College age, you sort of don't present, and so you're sort of accepted as mainstream, and so you're privy to how they talk about us, particularly how non-ethnic people talk about probably black people, that they might not speak the same way if they perceive you as Asian or as Asian American. Now, as someone who presents, you know, people assume that I'm just, my wife is a Nisei, and people assume that I'm big white husband of a Japanese American woman. And so my insights into, and by the time I was a junior in high school, I knew more about internment than Sansei's yeah. I met in college. But I can go into a family gathering in my wife's family, and people who don't know me will just assume I have no awareness. Yeah, so you sort of go through different phases.
Yeah.
None of them being acceptance, actually.
That's tough. I've got to assume that's really tough. Yes, ma'am.
Isn't that interesting? When I saw you here to speak to Joe, I said, well, I wonder what that white man is doing here.
You assume I'm somebody's husband whose wife yeah. is doing something and this is the one
yes,
I'm supposed to be in.
Yes, like either children or grandchildren who are half of them. I wonder what he's doing here. Really, I did.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'm a Hapa Yonsei.
Hapa Yonsei.
Mm-hmm. And growing up, all of my cousins, my mom, Irish, my dad, Japanese, all of my cousins have blonde hair and blue eyes. So they're my brother, my sister, and I, and we used to get out of and we were never treated equally by my mom's side of the family, so much that all of my cousins would get very expensive Christmas presents and birthday presents, and we would get what I was wearing.
Oh, man. That's tough. You know what? Can I interrupt? Because this is such a great discussion, and there's people from the audience that are much more interesting than me, maybe not as interesting as Dennis, but because everybody can't hear, and I know this is a little bit more scary, but could you come up and talk into the microphone? So I saw some other hands up too. Come up and talk to the microphone so that everybody can hear. You know, your experience as a Hapa Yonsei is... It's interesting.
Thanks. So, growing up, I don't think that I really felt like I fit in anywhere. With our family after World War II, to be good Americans, nobody talked about Japanese ancestry anymore. Nobody went to Japanese language school. Family heirlooms were destroyed. We were raised, my dad was raised very American. My dad doesn't speak Japanese. The only word I know is bakatada when I would get in trouble, that my grandma would call me. So,
you know, grandma's never changed. It's an amazing thing.
So I just didn't feel like I really fit in anywhere. And I remember in first grade, someone calling me slanty-eyed, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. I just knew that it was wrong because I felt like I looked like everybody else in class, that I was white. And, you know, just going through school, everybody else thought I was Japanese or Chinese, and then getting into junior high, everybody thought I was Mexican. So no one really quite understood what I was or where I was from. And it wasn't really until I went to Hawaii back in 2005 that I felt like I belonged, because I walked into a store and this guy who was probably a little bit older than my parents looked at me with this huge smile on his face, and he goes, "You're a Hapa, aren't you?" And I went, "Yeah, why?" He goes, "Oh, it's so good to see you," and he gave me a hug, and it was great. I looked at my husband, who's Hagajin, and I said, "I feel like I finally belong." So that's kind of my experience. Now I'm on the board of our JACL Arizona chapter, and our president is a Hapa. And so I don't feel like I guess I feel like I fit, and I'm okay with it because I am Hapa, and I'm proud to be a Hapa, and I don't look at it as being a slander. I look at it as I fit. And my sister and I relate everything back to food, and she had met a friend who lived out of state. He was from California, and when he met, he goes, "You're a banana." And she goes, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Sweetie, you're yellow on the outside, but you're white on the inside. You're a banana just like me." And so we jokingly call each other bananas in our family. And I have two children, and they look Japanese. And I call them my little quarter pounder kids because they're a quarter Japanese. But I guess my question is, we can talk about being Hapa, and is it... you know, do we fit? Do we not fit? But my thing is, when I fill out a form and they're like, "Okay, are you African American? Are you Indian? Are you Hispanic? Not white?" Or, you know, and I'm like, "I'm not any of those. I'm not Asian. I'm not white." And you can choose one box. And so when I was filling out my son's kindergarten registration form, there wasn't biracial, there wasn't multiracial. And I looked at my husband and I said, "Well, what am I supposed to fill out for him?" He goes, "Sweetie, he's Asian." And I'm like, "Well, sort of, but he's more white." He goes, "No, put down he's Asian, because if they look at this, he's going to get more scholarship money." So, yeah. But with
not the way the courts are going.
Yeah, exactly. There's a bill like that coming up for our Arizona elections in November. But looking at that, with the Yonseis that are marrying, you know, we're Hapas, we're marrying Hagajins, or we're marrying other people that aren't Japanese, what are we going to do with our kids, and where do our kids fit? And that's what I would like to focus on. How are we creating community for our children to be able to embrace what they are, that yes, you are still part Asian. And I figure if, what, being Native American, you get, even if you're 1/32nd, you still get some sort of, yes, you know, why can't we, even if our kids down the line are 1/32nd, why can't they embrace their Japanese ancestry? You know, and just to move past of getting away from the dissension of, you know, you don't fit anywhere, to we're our own subculture and we do fit. And how are we going to teach this to our kids? So.
Thank you. I have always felt that because the Hapa are our mixed race, you know, children are the future of Japanese American culture, that we need to embrace them and bring them into the Japanese American community. I think there's a place, and it's important for mixed race people to self-identify and to as a subgroup and to, you know each other and meet each other and share their all the issues that come with that. But geez, if without them, Japanese Americans are going to shrink and just disappear off the country. So it seems like we need to embrace mixed race kids as just full-fledged members of our community, and hope that they're interested in the cultural aspects and the values that we've kind of grown up with. And I don't know about you all, but I have in recent years heard the word kwapa for, you know, quarter. So that's just thought I'd throw that out there. It's another label, and I know that this is it is. It's a process of labeling people to put them into boxes and put them on a shelf. But I have heard kwapa being used. I saw some other hands, but Michelle, Dennis, do you want to jump in as well? What is the future of the next generation, the kids? Where do they fit?
I want to hear from some of those people that I saw the hands pop up. We've got a speaker now, so.
Come on up.
While you come on up, we'll talk.
Oh, Frank first, and then you can stand over here. That way you're committed. You can't pretend you never raised your hand. I know there's a couple of ladies out there. I saw you raise your hands.
I have two, I'd say, I guess they'll be Sanse Hapas. One is 25. One is going to be 26. The other is 28. And I think a couple of things. Number one, there has to be some sort of agreement about what we're going to call Hapas, because unless I'm mistaken, there is no word that is acceptable. They're all slurs. There's a Japanese word, Ainoko, which to me is really nice.
That was really the bad one.
Love child. But yeah, it's really a derogatory name. Yeah. So I think maybe we're stuck with that, but everybody else is referring themselves to Hapas. Number two, as far as I know, you should be reassured because you outnumber the JAs now. There's over a million something. And the third thing is that in observing my boys grow up, there was an occasion where there was a bunch of Hapa kids, both boys and girls. It was at an airport or something. And they all look alike. So you do all look alike, just like they say we all look alike. And you have your own distinct characteristics. And you're never going to get away from the prejudices that we all feel. You must understand, I'm Nisei, and I found out that the Japanese, mainly the Iseis and all, are amongst the most racist people that I've ever met. But they're coming around now, and the Nisei generation is better, the Sanseis will be better. My boys, and I think a lot of this, whatever you experience, depends on where you live. My boys were born and raised in Los Angeles, Culver City to be specific. They're both into music. My older boy is on tour now. And every once in a while I ask them, son, have you ever experienced prejudice? And they say, oh, never. Has anybody ever questioned you about your origin? No, you know, Nakano, Genji Nakano. It's a Japanese name. My ex-wife is Dutch, so she gave our second son a Dutch name, Bastian Nakano. So that's pretty foreign sounding. And so I'd ask him every once in a while, and up until last night, actually it was today, my 26-year-old, soon to be 26, borrowed his father-in-law's car and drove down to Colorado Springs, actually Manitou Springs, for the day, because he has a friend there. And when I asked him the question today, because I was looking forward to this session, I said, you know, have you ever experienced anything? I described it as, if you experienced it, and I'm sure Gil has experienced it, you have a sixth sense, you walk into a room, and right away you know you're among people that are questioning your identity for whatever reason. It's just, boom, it's there. If it's not there, it's not there. So he looked at me, he says, you know, Dad? He says, it happened last night. He says, I never experienced it before. Manitou Springs, they ended up at some club, and he says, I was the only Asian there. And all of a sudden, I felt a little funny. The people were looking at me funny. I said, what do you mean they're looking at me? So well, they kind of was looking at me with questioning eyes. And that was the very first time at the age of almost 26 that he felt this. So I think that's kind of a good sign, because my older boy, 28, he says he's never felt. At any rate, I think that was about it.
Good anecdote. Thank you. Manitou Springs is actually a fairly liberal, progressive, hippy-dippy arts culture kind of place.
It is. So.
Interesting. And yes.
You kind of mentioned where the community is going, since soon most that view themselves as being Japanese American will be mixed race, it would seem. I remember a few years ago, I live in San Francisco, and in Japantown in San Francisco, someone had put up a bunch of handbills on all these light poles about what are we going to do about intermarriage in an effort to stop it, because for so long the Japanese community and many Japanese people felt, well, you're not supposed to marry outside the race, but there's nothing they could do about that. There's a Nisei woman who lives in my building, and she, of course, took us right under, you know, the wing, and she brings us kiwis from the farm in Sacramento and everything. But she has, on numerous occasions, said, you know, pretty soon there'll be no real Japanese people left. You'll all be mixed because no one marries Japanese anymore. And so, but that's just a fact of life, and that's actually more or less a good thing. So it shows that this racial division coming down, but it certainly is the future of the community, and the individuals like myself who have been, I believe, well educated by my grandparents and great aunts and uncles to appreciate the Issei and Nisei experience and the resiliency of the community, good traditional values that are based on community responsibility and how your actions affect not just yourself but others and your perception of your community. But it's important to teach that and not to lose a lot of those good lessons and good old-fashioned Japanese values, the good ones, you know, not the sort of, you know, keep everybody else out values, but the inclusionary ones and the good principles of Japanese culture. And so I'm really glad that my family educated me in a lot of those things, and I think it's important that we keep that and that people who are a half, a quarter, an eighth, whatever, on down the road, everybody, because those values will just get disseminated to the community in general. And that's a good thing. And so looking at the future of this community, it's important to keep the good things going, to pass them down.
Thank you. You know, part of what I get from this is that it's not necessarily the racial part, but it's about the values and the kind of the education, the socializing that you get from your family dynamics and how your culture is handed down to you. So Michelle and Dennis, both. Dennis, let me ask you first. Because you were put into an orphanage, you didn't have a very Japanese-American initial upbringing or Japanese upbringing, and then you were thrown into Manzanar where I assume you suddenly found yourself in the midst of a lot more Japanese than you'd ever seen before. What was that like?
Well, I didn't know I was Japanese.
Exactly. Who are these people?
And
why are you throwing me in with these guys?
And so let me tell you that sociologists tell us that if you are of mixed race, there are a series of lifetime experiences which you will have to go through in order to reach the success, whatever you are looking for. And so something you just said about the value system, you're right. I don't know where my value system came from.
Now maybe it is.
Because I'm an orphan. And the only value system that I can remember in the orphanage was my nurse feeding me. And that's the only value system I learned. When I got to Manzanar, because I was a Hapa, I was an outsider. And as an outsider, I had to learn how to get inside. And I don't think I made it. But I will tell you that my experiences are consistent, and I would best describe them as trying to enter the Japanese culture. That was the problem for me.
Michelle, what was your... Well, you lived in Japan when you were young, so it was probably easier to somehow be rooted, right? But what was your family dynamics like? Did your dad speak English? Your mom spoke?
Well, my mother, yeah, learned to speak English. Mm-hmm. My dad didn't learn to speak Japanese. But we learned as kids. We learned Japanese and English simultaneously. And I've tried now as an adult to try and figure out some of the mothering skills that my mom had, because, you know, she never had to yell at us or make a scene or anything like that in the grocery store. And when I had my kids, I was like, why am I not able to just give them that look, you know, where they'll just stop? Because that's what my brother and I did. There was a certain look and we would just stop. And, you know, really I was raised with a sense of, in some ways it's really good, and in some ways it's you know, there are some things that you need to let go of, right? But a sense of, like, my actions reflected not only on myself as an individual, which is a very westernized concept, but that, you know, they really reflected on my family. And so in a lot of ways, I think, you know, growing up, I had to stop and think, especially as a teenager, about some of the actions that I took, because I knew if my mom or her friends especially, if they found out about it, my mom would be completely embarrassed and shamed, and her friends would, you know, not look upon me too kindly. And so that was really, that kept me, I think, in a lot of ways from acting out. You know, in certain ways. I mean, not that it was so oppressive, but I think that there really actually is some positive to that, you know, I don't want to say this, but maybe there's a shame factor, you know, you don't want to shame your family, but it's pretty effective, you know, and so now I'm trying to figure out how to do that with my own kids, because it doesn't seem to work with them so much. But I really do feel like that's the one important thing, the really important value that I got from my mom, and that is that really, you know, you're not just an individual. You are part of a family, and you're part of a community and a larger group. And so, you know, really think about your behaviors and the actions and the decisions that you make, because whether you like it or not, they do reflect on your family, if not your community.
Hey, Gil?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to relate a story that I discovered in preparing for coming today.
Great.
And I'm relating this story to those young people out in the audience, and I'm sure that all of us will relate to the story, but, you know, the more we understand, the better off we are able to adapt and fit in or establish our own lifestyles. But there was a lady by the name of Sue Kunitomi Embry, who is responsible for the development of Manzanar. She's a leader. When she decided to marry a white man, the biggest resistance came from her mother. She felt, no, wait a minute. Yes, she felt that I was really marrying beneath me. The Japanese consider themselves quite superior to everybody else. She couldn't understand why I couldn't marry a nice Japanese boy. And she kept telling me this 2 years after my husband and I were married. I'd go see her and she'd say, "Why don't you divorce your husband and marry a nice Japanese boy?" The mother's animosity was so intense that she threw her daughter out of the home shortly before the wedding. Refused to come to the ceremony and ignored Embry's repeated attempts at reconciliation. Relations stalled only moderately when grandchildren arrived. That's a pretty impressive and thought-provoking story.
And probably familiar to a lot of Japanese if you've grown up in a, well, Asian family or maybe ethnic family or immigrant family in general. There's a list of people you're allowed to date, and other Asians are on that list, and Caucasians are not, you know, they're on the list, but you know, you can't fight it. And anyway, I'll leave that one alone. But there's in a similar vein, much more recently than Sue Embry's experience, when I got divorced from my first wife, who was Caucasian, and I called up my parents, and my mom answered the phone, and I said, "Hey, Mom, hey, I'm really sorry, but you know what? Terry and I are going to get a divorce." Her first words weren't, "Oh, I'm so sorry," or, "Gee, are you okay?" Or what? Her first words were, "See, I told you you should marry Japanese." "Thanks, Ma. Appreciate the words of support." So, we are, in some ways, you know, we just haven't moved very far. That bar hasn't moved very far. So, your name is Tamo, right?
Tamio,
can you talk to a little bit about your family dynamics? Because I know that you are very involved in the Asian community or the Japanese community in New York, and that you and your wife host meetings, and you work really hard, you know, within that community to keep the culture alive, and you have lots of cool little gatherings. And I remember when I lived in New York, that I guess I made it to one. Jeez, my memory is so weird about my 6 months in New York. Okay, but that I wanted to come to these things because I would get your emails, and I never could, you know, something would always come up or whatever. But could you come up and talk to us about your family dynamics and how you kept alive? Because I think that question is really important. How do you spark the interest in Japanese community and culture and values in the future generations of mixed race Japanese?
It gets even weirder. But my mother, as I said, my mother was interned at Heart Mountain when she was, I believe, 13. So she graduated high school at Heart Mountain, and with a 442 grant scholarship, came east. Those of us who are sort of sanseis in New York have a theory that the people who went east after camp were the people who were a little angrier, maybe, and less willing to try and restore the cultural infrastructure that existed in California on the West Coast, you know, at the time of internment. My mother was a very angry Nisei from the day she went into camp to the day she passed away in 2000. And so I grew up with an awareness of the internment from a very early age. Probably when I was in third or fourth, in second or third grade, I was probably reading Citizen 13660, which you should buy because the bookstore here sells it. And it's a very easy book to read, and it's an incredibly honest and accurate portrayal of life in the camps. So I knew that. After camp, my mother in New York fell into an art and left-wing politics, where she met my father, who was a Jewish American labor organizer. And they were in a social circle that involved Niseis, African Americans, and Hispanic Americans. So those of you who know the Kochiamas or the Kanazawas, there were one or two Japanese grocery stores in Harlem at the time. So we grew up with a very, at the same time that we celebrated, and both my parents were not religious, so that we grew up with a cultural identity of an identity of being Jewish as a cultural ethnic phenomenon, and being Japanese American, which really was completely colored by internment. And I've only come to realize in the last year that my perception of myself as a Japanese American is completely tied up with internment, whereas that's not the common experience even among my contemporary sanseis who didn't grow up with an awareness of internment because their parents didn't tell them about it. Uh-huh. And I've only realized that recently, really within the last year.
Interesting.
So, but in New York, there is no, or there has been no Little Tokyo. I don't know how much longer there'll be a Little Tokyo anywhere.
There's that block, though, in the village that's between...
Yeah, but you see, those are recent immigrants.
Right.
The Japanese community, what's good about New York, like in New York right now, you can get great Japanese groceries because there's such an influx of Japanese immigrants. And we're talking about people in their 20s and 30s who are sort of these very wonderful young Japanese people who don't fit into a very structured, socially structured society. So they come to New York, where they have some freedom, but they love their food and they love their music and they love their culture. So we benefit from that, but it's not Japanese American. And not to belabor this Hapa thing, people who are recent immigrants from Japan don't have a problem with being called a Jap.
No, I know Japanese. The word is not a bad thing.
So we have to teach them why that's a bad word. Until this recent wave of immigration, to maintain our identity as Japanese Americans, you have to work extra hard in New York because you can't go downtown and hang and be around people. I had the same experience, by the way, when I was 14. I mean, I stepped off the plane in Hawaii, and it's as if a huge weight is lifted from your shoulders. And anybody who's of mixed race who hasn't been to Hawaii, make your parents take you.
Because Hawaii is a mixed race place.
Because nobody cares what you look like. Nobody.
Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. And you feel it immediately. Whereas everywhere, and then you realize, I realized when I was 14, I'm walking around with my guard up when I go home. You know, so anyway, but in New York, what we're doing now is continuing to do things that sort of make for, a social infrastructure, because we don't have a physical place to go where we can be around each other and feel comfortable. And what we're feeling now is this sort of wave of, the influx or the impact of recent Japanese immigration and just generally globalization, cultural globalization. Japanese American identity is really something you have to work at, you know, pretty much every day.
What's interesting is that in New York, because of business, there's still an influx of Japanese business people. The rest of the country, Japanese immigration's dropped to near nothing. So that impact is getting less and less, and so more and more the kind of the continuing mix of Japanese and other races is becoming kind of the Japanese communities in other places. Even in California. So we have like 8 minutes left, and George, who is from Hawaii, George has to talk. Okay, he's let George talk.
I think the main thing, as you stated, is a sense of identity, and that's a separate. Conference.
Put it to your mouth.
Because I think how you perceive your identity is very important, okay? But you know, Dennis, I think you bring up a good point. Different markers, you know, as you indicated. My granddaughter is a Hapa. She doesn't look Japanese, she's more Caucasian.
Okay? She looks Hawaiian.
Well, the reason for that is she's been to Hawaii 8 different times, okay?
She got the permanent Hawaiian tan?
Yeah, right. No, as you indicated, and you indicated, you have to go to Hawaii to know really what a Hapa means, because you're accepted and they do have a sense of identity, okay? But I think the bigger problem is going to be the other ethnic groups that are Hapas. The Filipino community has grown, and there's a lot of Hapas there. The Vietnamese community have a lot of Hapa. They're going to pose a lot of problems, and also, I mean, as their kids grow up, they're going to have a lot of problems.
George, okay, you're not saying they're going to pose a lot of problems.
They're going to have a problem.
So they're having problems. They're going to have problems.
For me, with my granddaughter looking more Caucasian, you know, when I go to a restaurant and my granddaughter turns to me and say, "Grandpa," or "Grandma," everybody looks at us. Here I got a Hapa girl who's taller than both of us, and they look at two Japanese. They say, "What's going on?" So that's a reality. So I think, you know, a sense of identity is going to be the key. You have to believe in yourself and be proud of yourself. And I think identification is very important. Because, you know, the Hapa population is not going to be only Japanese. It's going to be other ethnic groups having a lot of Hapa issues and problems.
Thank you. We have 5 minutes left. Yes, you can talk, and then I want some people to get some courage up here. I would like somebody who's in a mixed race relationship, and I see, to talk about, you know, if you have kids, or maybe you already have kids, but how do you inspire that sense of identity if you have mixed race kids? So just something to think about. Go ahead.
I just, you know, as a Hapa person, and I have this fear of our community shrinking, the Nikkei community. And somebody had said there's just as many Hapa as there are Japanese, full-blooded Japanese American. I don't know what the right term is for that. But yet our organizations are getting smaller and smaller. And, you know, as I know some other JCL board members here, and, you know, it's always like, how do we get young people involved? And I mean, I guess I would like to say a challenge to all of us. Like, we all have cousins or kids or neighbors or friends that are Japanese American that are not engaged in the community at all. And I think it's because of the war. I mean, there's many things that have created the reasons why we may not be drawn to our Japanese American heritage, but to really try to talk to our friends and our family members so that these kinds of conferences can go on and we can have this for our kids when it comes time for them to figure out these identity issues. But it's up to us to keep it going.
Thank you. That's true. The organizations like JACL, and I was a board member of JACL for the last 6 years, and please come up to the mic, and also organizations like the Japanese American National Museum. These are issues that these kinds of organizations are tackling head on. Please support these organizations, and I want to thank Janum while I still have a chance here, and before I forget, for putting on this conference and bringing it to Denver, because this is one of the coolest things to happen in Denver. And will be until at least the Democratic National Convention next month.
I'm Caucasian, and I've got my two daughters sitting over there, and they are Yonsei Hapa. And I just wanted to share a story. Last week, my youngest, who's 5, had a play date, and we were having ramen noodles. And one of her playmates said, "Oh, we're eating Chinese." And she said, "No, we're eating Japanese, because I'm half Japanese and half plain."
Like yogurt. Right on.
So I am the plain parent. But my girls very much relate that they are Japanese. That's what they think they are. That's what we, I guess I could be doing a better job with my half. But and Anna, my oldest, is in first grade, going into second grade, and she's got 15 kids in her class, and 4 of them are mixed race Asian. of different Korean, Vietnamese, and Chinese. So, and we live in Douglas County, so we live in a very Caucasian area. And I think
the term is white bread.
Yeah, I think it's just becoming more and more. I hope that my kids don't experience what some of you have talked about not belonging. I hope that they always feel like they belong wherever they go.
Well, let's hope the world is changing enough that that'll happen, and that parents like you can help that happen. And I'd like to point out that ramen actually is a Chinese dish. My mom considers it Chinese. And she being the Japanese that she is, she won't eat it. One more question. We have 1 minute. Anybody have like a 20-second question?
Well, I have a 20-second statement.
There you go. You got 18 left.
I do these, or I make presentations. And I just want to say to you that the matter of the intermarriage is something we can't control. But we can control what we teach our children and our relatives about our background and our history. And so if you leave today with the understanding that you need to go forward and tell a story to your kids, to your grandkids, I hope you'll do that.
Amen.
Because that's the way we will continue presenting our culture. Thank you very much.
Very nice. Thank you very much, Dennis. Michelle, thank you. Thank you all for speaking up and coming to this, and I hope that we've all have some food for thought. To come up.
And just one more thing, I'm sorry. I have a handout up here for anybody who's interested.
Oh, yes.
Kind of 50 experiences of racially mixed people, Hapas. And some of them are funny, some of them are kind of sad, but anyway, I have them up here if you'd like to just come by and grab one.
Things like you've been told you have to choose, you can't be both. Yeah. Or your ethnicity was mistakenly identified, people assumed your race to be different by phone than in person, stuff like that.
Remarks.